Two Sisters, a novel by Jeffrey Anderson, serial number 6, read by the author. Part 1 of the chapter titled The Ring. At some point early in her teens, Leah couldn't say exactly when, Shaunatuck Island became Brooke's vision of Shangri-La. They'd known about the small island off the coast, accessible only by ferry, for years, with no paved streets, just boards laid across the sand, and a few hundred year-round residents tripled during the summer months with the influx of renters and hardy or poor or ignorant souls sleeping in tents in the no-see-em-infested campground, and with swarms of mosquitoes waiting outside the tent if anyone attempted to flee the no-see-ems. They received these and many other details about the island from Auntie Greta, the self-described black lamb of Mama's family, the youngest of 6 children. Greta had followed a native islander from the Coastal State College out to the island one summer long ago, and though the boy married a local girl, first cousins, Greta said, she'd chosen to stay on anyway, living in a small cottage and painting watercolors she sold to tourists for a pittance and swapped with locals for services or supplies. Brooke and Leah would see Auntie Greta once a year, the day after Christmas at Mem and Pap's house, Mama's parents, for their annual family gathering. Father and Mama and the sisters and Matt, sulking in one corner of the back seat, far back as anyone could remember, would leave mid-morning for the 2-hour drive down east on thinly traveled but well-maintained roads. Auntie Greta, according to her version, would have to rise before dawn and brave stormy seas on the decrepit ferry, then drive for interminable, her word, hours through swamps infested with snakes and cloaked in spooky fog, just to reach the highway pointed west toward her birthplace. From there on, it was smooth sailing, she'd always conclude, letting the girls and anyone else who was listening, most weren't, know that mainland travel was an exercise in privilege and pampering. Greta gave the sisters handmade presents and animal figures made out of shells when they were younger, then photos of the ocean or sunsets mounted in driftwood frames lined with shells, and, more recently, jewelry, bracelets, and necklaces with the shells held together by monofilament fishing line. She'd always dismiss their awe and praise with a wave of her arm and an "aw shucks, that's nothing." But then later, after dinner and a couple glasses of sherry, she'd sit in the soft upholstered chair in her old bedroom with a sister on each knee or each armrest once they'd grown taller, and describe in detail where she'd found the shells she'd used in their gifts, and how from the moment she'd spotted them in the water or on the sand, she had a vision of their final placement, a vision that linked that particular shell to either Brooke or Leah through the hand and heart of Auntie Greta, her face weathered and worn beyond its years. Maybe that was what had captured Brooke's imagination at a formative moment, Auntie Greta's passion and the romance implicit in her life story. Or maybe it was the romantic appeal of Shaunatuck Island itself, cut off from the world and time, even its language preserving the Elizabethan accents and vocabulary of its 17th century settlers, idiom that would make Brooke laugh and cause Leah to tilt her head in much the way she had on viewing Romeo and Juliet. Leah, for her part, never understood Brooke's fascination. The Shaunatuck Island she knew, both from Greta's stories and her face, seemed a harsh and demanding place that shaped its residents, human and otherwise, far more than they shaped it. Though she loved all the gifts Auntie Greta gave her, it was a watercolor Greta had given her parents that most vividly represented both her aunt and her aunt's adopted home. It was of an ancient, gnarled live oak, shaped by and locked in perpetual battle with invisible gale force winds. So starting at about age 13, every spring Brooke would ask Mama if they could go to Shaunatuck this summer for their annual beach vacation. And every year Mama would give the same unbudging answer. It was too far, the ferry service was unreliable, and what would they do if a hurricane came along during their stay? She never mentioned that Father and Greta had a history, and an even greater hurricane might form if those two were kept in proximity for days, let alone weeks. Instead, each year they made their mid-July pilgrimage to the same second-row cottage on Bogue Beach, a thin strip of barrier island sand firmly anchored to the mainland by a four-lane drawbridge and stocked with many of the amenities of home: supermarkets, arcades, movie theaters, libraries, and even some of the same residents when the vacation dates coincidentally overlapped. The summer Brooke was 16 and still on her learner's permit, but not in the vagaries of beach traffic, Father made clear before they left home. The Garrisons overlapped their first week on Bogue, staying at a plush beachfront place a block to the east. Within a day, Brooke had decided that Jennifer Garrison, a year behind her in school, was her new best friend, perhaps in part because Stuart Garrison, a year ahead in school, looked a whole lot more alluring dressed in swimming trunks and backlit by the beach's sunshine than he did back home. Jennifer was happy for Brooke's attention, whatever their origins, as they palled around with long walks on the beach, afternoons at the pier's arcade, and evenings strolling, or, as Brooke said, trolling, the beach and gently rocking pier thrust far out into the ocean and stocked with fishermen lolling and smoking and watching the teenage girls strolling past out of the corners of their eyes. By then, Mama had reluctantly allowed Brooke to start wearing two-piece suits, but not too skimpy, and her sister's breasts, though still small, were perkily displayed in those suits or under the bright tank top with her bra strap peeking out beneath the thin shoulder straps. Leah, with no breasts displayed within her one-piece suit, was not invited on any of the girls' excursions and, truth be told, just as glad. She didn't like Jennifer, who talked too fast and with the annoying habit of looking down when she spoke, leaving Leah confused about her words and acting stupid in her presence. Leah was, this year, content with their old beach pursuits, taking long walks with Mama and Father. Matt was off at Boys State, a two-week on-campus retreat for rising high school seniors, and collecting shells in her plastic bucket, making a sandcastle or two, burying Father's legs in mounds of fragrant and sloppy dark sand. It was as if she knew, by watching Brooke change, that these family moments were fleeting, and she should enjoy and preserve them long as she could. And all the other times she read, on the beach under the umbrella, on the chaise on the cottage's screen porch, curled up in the soft cushioned chair in the open family room, or in the top bunk before going to sleep or on waking. The books she brought from home, borrowed from the library, were all 19th century novels by women: Wuthering Heights, Jane Eyre, Pride and Prejudice, Middlemarch. There were also a few recent additions on the cottage's bookshelf, and she read all those by women, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, Delta Wedding, and If Morning Ever Comes. Between her real parents and her imagined lives, Leah hardly missed her sister during Brooks' garrison week. She was almost glad to be on the sidelines, spared the burden of having to try to understand her sister's choices and evolving behavior. Brooke would go out every evening, oh, just hanging out with Jen, while Father wrestled with the rabbit ears of the TV in hopes of getting a snowy version of Kojak or Bonanza, and Mama sat at the dining table and leafed through her Red Book magazines, smoking her daily cigarette. And Leah escaped into her fictional worlds that generally seemed more real than the cottage world her body occupied. Then the three would retire, and Leah would lie in the upper bunk with the lights out and nothing but the smell of salt air and the brush of a saturated breeze and the occasional flash of headlights crossing the far wall. And she would let her fictional world blur into an imagining of what Brooke was doing at that moment. And in those imaginings, Jennifer Garrison was nowhere present, and not even Stuart Garrison, but men, not boys, always properly dressed in Victorian wool suits and leaning over and whispering, yes, whispering in her mind, and imagining of what it was like to hear, of the sense of sound that somehow matched in texture and feel the wisp of salt-laden air, the brush of a feather, the crumple of a tissue. And following that whisper with a chaste kiss on the cheek, a solicitous smile, a fathomless stare that was nonetheless known and understood. These were Brooke's adventures out of sight that became Leah's adventures lying there on the dark bed. Then Brooke would arrive back at the cottage, always faithfully at 11:29 on the dresser clock's digital face, exactly 29 minutes past her curfew, just short of raising Mama's ire, and Brooke would sneak in the never-locked side door. Leah felt the vibration of Brooke's footsteps on the side landing, across the kitchen, up the stairs, and down the hall. With her head cushioned in the pillow and one eye open, she'd see her sister slip into the bedroom, carefully close the door, then slide out of her clothes and into her pajamas, sometimes holding on to the bedpost for support. Then Brooke would disappear from sight as the bunks rocked ever so slightly from side to side. And at that moment, Leah's imagining of Brooke's experiences out of sight would transition from the idealized version of Victorian courtship and heartbreak to the rough-edged reality of wine-tainted breath and the faint scent of someone not of this house. Leah's mind wouldn't build outward from those stimuli, not that it couldn't, but that it chose not to. Sleep proved a welcome refuge then, and the next morning, after swinging down from the upper bunk, she'd leave a stick of gum beside Brooke's sleeping head before scurrying off to the bathroom, then the sandbars unmarred by human or dog print. The Garrisons left after the first week, and Brooke seemed relieved. The only direct reference she made to her time away was on their first walk together along the incoming tide that hazy Saturday morning as the Garrisons were packing to leave, and Brooke made a point of being as far away as the close confines of Bogue Beach would allow. When they were to the end of Walkable Beach, where a wide creek of inrushing seawater blocked their way, Brooke paused before turning and said simply, "He was more fun to look at then spend time with. Leah had tilted her head and waited for further explanation on both points, as she didn't think of Stuart as even sort of fun to look at, all gangly and with a shock of dark hair permanently across his right eye, and couldn't imagine spending time with the dour, withdrawn soul. But Brooke met her question with a light-hearted giggle and a piece of seaweed pulled off the jetty and trailing out behind her like a pennant as she ran prancing through the shallow water, shouting something that Leah finally recognized as, "I'm free!" during a return pass just before Brooke trailed the slimy seaweed across Leah's head. More explanation on what Brooke had done came later in the day, when she gestured with a finger over her lips for Leah to follow, after she glanced around to see that no one was watching, then darted onto the rocks underneath the pier, where it tied into the shore. From the beach, those rocks looked solid, like a wall underpinning the pier and the arcade and the market that separated that pier street from the parking lot, and controlled access to it. But once on the slippery, algae-coated rocks, Leah saw that there were gaps between these boulders under the pier. Most of these gaps were barely big enough to fit your hand into, and who would be brave or foolish enough to do that, risking the pinch of a crab or sting of a jellyfish or worse? But Brooke led her up the rock wall to a boulder near the top, where the rough beams supporting the pier deck intersected this foundation. And on the right-hand side, then Brooke disappeared. Leah felt a brief gasp of panic. Had Brooke fallen into a hole? But then she felt equally sudden relief when Brooke reappeared in the shadowy dark beneath the pier deck and waved her on. Leah scurried across the rocks to where Brooke could reach her hand. Then her sister helped pull her up the last and steepest boulder to a narrow ledge so close to the pier deck that she could reach up and touch the bottom of the boards forming the walk, and had to duck under the beams supporting that walk. Then Brooke, still holding her hand, shimmied along the narrow ledge with her body tight to the boulder, and pulled Leah into a small cave behind the boulder and between two of the pier beams, barely big enough for them and entirely invisible until you were right upon it. In the thin light that sifted down through the cracks between the pier decking, Leah could see the rocks up this high were clean and dry, and that someone had wedged a piece of driftwood into the notches in the rock walls to form a rudimentary bench. Brooke sat on the driftwood now and pulled Leah onto the seat beside her. "What do you think?" Brooke asked with evident pride and satisfaction. Leah thought it both the most captivating and frightening hideaway she'd ever seen. She felt like she was on a different planet, but simultaneously wondered about all the risks. What if the incoming tide rose higher than normal and drowned them? What if the boulders shifted and trapped them? What if some snake or giant crab emerged from the crevices and attacked them? Brooke laughed. "Relax, Leah," she mouthed with her lips and tongue and teeth moving with the exaggerated precision that told Leah she wasn't making sounds. "It's safe." Just then someone walked directly overhead, casting a shadow down through the cracks in the boards and sifting a little sand onto their knees. Leah jumped in surprise. Brooke quickly threw one of her hands over Leah's mouth and raised the other to put a finger over her lips. Leah, wide-eyed in the dim light, slowly nodded, understanding. Brooke lowered her hands and mouthed, "No one knows we're here. It's our secret." Leah stared at her sister, her eyes framing the obvious question. You didn't find this place on your own. Someone else knows about it. Brooke laughed and said, But he's gone. Then she wrapped her arms around her own torso, closed her eyes, and puckered her lips in a mock kiss. Brooke opened her eyes just enough to see Leah's understanding and astonishment. She raised one finger, then leaned back into a half-reclining position against the rock walls, closed her eyes again, and made like more kissing, rumpling her hair with one hand, using her other arm to push an imaginary hand away, first from her breasts, then from her waist. After many seconds of this miming that extended past demonstration and into the realm of fond and perhaps slightly sorrowful recollection, Brooke finally sat up, opened her eyes, and shrugged to her sister in a gesture that needed no words to say, He's gone. You're here. I'm better off. For the briefest of instants, Leah wondered about the lure in boys that would bring Brooke to such a place and such a state with someone as insubstantial as Stuart Garrison, or, for that matter, with anyone, not your soul twin. But realizing she could not answer that question, could not understand, not now anyway, Leah dismissed the question and simply gazed at her sister, with her mouth slightly open in an expression of thanks for her sister's return, a conveyance of a week's worth of stored love. Brooke understood. She had a way of always understanding Leah, even if Leah so rarely understood her, and reached out and cupped Leah's chin and said in a whisper, spoken words Leah could tell, I missed you, Leah. No matter what I do or how stupid I act, we are always together. Brooke lowered her hand and held it out between them in the dim light, palm out, thumb and fingers pointed up. Leah raised her hand and pressed it against her sister's, her fingers long as Brooke's and pushed tight, tip to tip. Brooke smiled, parted her fingers, and let Leah's twine naturally between hers. Brooke pulled the paired hands to her lips in a kiss that might, or might not, have recalled Stuart. It hardly mattered to Leah the reason why. The end of Two Sisters, serial number 6.